Today's Taisho will be on Case 42 in the Mumonkan, the Gate of No Barrier. Case 42 is entitled, The Girl Comes Out of Samadhi. Once, in the old days, in the time of the World-Honored One, the Buddha, Manjushri went to the assembly of the Buddhas and found that everyone had departed to his original dwelling place. Only a girl remained, sitting in samadhi close to the Buddha's throne. Manjushri asked Shakyamuni Buddha, "Why can the girl get near the Buddha's throne while I cannot?" Shakyamuni Buddha said, "Bring her out of samadhi and ask her yourself." Manjushri walked around the girl three times, snapping his fingers once, lifted her up to the Brahma heaven, and exerted all his miraculous powers to bring her out of meditation, but in vain. The world-honored one said, "Even 100,000 Manjushris cannot make her wake up, but down below, past 1,200 million lands, as innumerable as the sands of the Ganges, there is the Bodhisattva Momyo. He will be able to rouse her from her samadhi." Instantly, the Bodhisattva Momyo emerged from the earth and made a bow to the world-honored one, who gave him his order. The Bodhisattva went over to the girl and snapped his fingers once. At this, she came out of samadhi. Mumon's comment, old Shakyamuni put a petty drama on the stage and failed to enlighten the masses. I want to ask you, Manjushri is the teacher of the seven Buddhas. Why couldn't he arouse the girl from her samadhi? How was it that Momyo, a bodhisattva at the beginner's stage, could do it? If you understand this intimately, you will enjoy Nagya's grand samadhi in the busiest activity of consciousness. Mumon's verse, one was successful, the other was not. Both secured freedom of mind. One in a god mask, the other in a devil mask, even in defeat, a beautiful performance. Some of you may be here for the first time and may not be familiar with koans. What I just read was known in Zen as a koan. Koans are stories that are used in Zen training to help students break through their illusions. Usually the stories are a little bit shorter and less elaborate than this one, but they usually involve some event where a person is confronting an obstacle or becomes confused, breaks through the barrier, and is able to experience enlightened mind in some way. Some of the koans are quite simple. They involve one monk slapping another monk. They involve a brief conversation about a flag flying outside the monastery. Some are more complex. Usually every koan has a core or a kernel, in particular a phrase or several words that the meditator internalizes and repeats like a mantra. So there's a very famous koan that goes like this. What is the sound of one hand clapping? Now, you know, if you hear a question like that, what is the sound of one hand clapping, you may imagine that it's asking you to engage in thinking, in philosophical thinking. So you might realize, you know, it's impossible for somebody to clap with one hand. But maybe the koan is making a statement about the possible and the impossible, and so on and so on. So sometimes the koans seem to invite reflection or contemplation or inquiry or discriminating thought. But that would be, to see koans in that way would be a big mistake. You know, the purpose of a koan is to be internalized and processed on an unconscious level. So if you're wondering what distinguishes Zen, the Zen school, from, say, Vipassana, they're very similar in many ways, but the Zen school puts a great deal of emphasis, like other schools in the Mahayana, on the power of the unconscious to help us liberate ourselves from illusion. So the koan operates primarily on an unconscious level. When your teacher gives you a koan, you should read the whole story and acquaint yourself with the particular details. But it's also important to be able to enter deep concentration and mental stabilization, to enter samadhi, and then to internalize the key words or phrase of the koan. So in the case of the koan, what is the sound of one hand clapping? That's a little bit too much to internalize. So you really should just internalize a hand. Hand. Okay. Sometimes a teacher will help you identify what you need to internalize. But if you sit with saying hand, and you treat the word hand like a mantra in the context of this koan, it begins to have a psychoactive quality, begins to operate on an unconscious level to help you confront and work through the internal barriers that prevent us from being fully awake, from being fully awake from moment to moment. So this is a koan that's a little bit more complicated. It's a story. It takes place in a mythical, dreamlike setting. There really are discourses of the historical Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama. Those are recorded for us in the Pali Sutras. These are translated into English, and I hope you'll read them. The Pali Sutras are really quite wonderful, and some of them are deeply inspiring and illuminating. So, it's probably the case that the Pali Sutras represent the actual teachings of the historical Buddha, although there's some disagreement about particular details. The Mahayana Sutras, such as the Heart Sutra or the Diamond Sutra, the Huayan Sutra, the Flower Ornament Sutra, really aren't the words of the historical Buddha. They're called sutras, but they were actually produced much later in Indian history. And they are connected to schools of meditation, and they reflect particular discoveries made by great meditation teachers. So, for example, the Diamond Sutra, if you read it, makes a number of statements that might not make sense if you're in ordinary consciousness. So one of the claims of the Diamond Sutra is that form is empty and empty is form. Well, most people don't really experience emptiness very directly, but if you meditate for a long time, you will have very direct and powerful experiences of emptiness, and you will have powerful experiences of form, or the world we ordinarily experience as the material world. So the sutra is claiming that form and emptiness are actually the same, and this is a complicated claim, and it's not really something most people can test using their own experience. But if you've been meditating for many years and you're a very advanced meditation practitioner, the state of awareness that the Diamond Sutra describes will really be accessible to you. You really will be able to experience the truth of this claim. So the Mahayana Sutras are really connected to schools of meditation, and you could think of them as like research reports. After the Buddha's death, meditation didn't stop in the Buddhist world. There were many, many thousands of men and women who continued to explore reality from the standpoint of non-dualistic awareness. These are men and women who meditated many hours a day and explored the nature of reality from their non-dualistic mind, from the standpoint of non-dualistic awareness. Seated on their cushions, they explored reality. So Buddhism doesn't really stop with the Buddha's teachings. It builds on the Buddha's teachings. But Buddhism is like a project for the liberation of all human beings from suffering and illusion. And it's an ongoing project that has involved, as I say, tens of thousands of people meditating, asking questions about the nature of reality, and developing techniques that will help people wake up. So one of the techniques that people developed was the koan technique. And koans are basically stories that involve people struggling to wake up. We Zen students internalize key phrases in those stories, and we meditate with them for long periods of time, and eventually they produce an opening. The Japanese word for opening is kensho. This is like, normally, you know, we don't really encounter reality directly. We encounter reality through a film of our assumptions and fears, our ideas. So it's difficult for us to really experience reality as it actually is. You know, normally we experience a mix of our own preconceptions and reality. Sort of it's mixed up, you know. So when we have an opening, we see things as they really are, free from our assumptions, our beliefs. It's just pure experience of the world as it is. This is very difficult, actually, for humans to achieve. But the Buddha said that if you can experience the world as it actually is, you will experience personal sense of liberation, freedom, joy, stability, trust. You know. So if we can get into contact with the world as it really is, we will experience liberation. This is like basic belief of Buddhism. So this koan is later Buddhism. The story involves later Buddhism. It comes out of a sutra in which Buddha is imagined as a kind of transcendental figure. In the early sutras, the Pali sutras, Buddha, it's really very realistic. Buddha is represented as a person. The Samantabhadra, all of these different bodhisattvas are just people. But as Buddhism develops, in some of the sutras, Buddha takes on like supernatural characteristics. So the real Buddha couldn't make people come out of the ground, and there were no transcendental or miraculous meeting places of all the Buddhas, and they would sit on thrones. This is somebody's imagination. So the koan comes out of later Buddhism, and it's trying to make a point about how we experience the world. It's trying to show us something about how we experience reality or fail to experience reality. And it would be better if you treated it as a kind of mythical story, mythical tale. It's speaking to us on a level like poetry or art. Not on the level of literal truth. Okay. So, It involves this mythical setting where all the Buddhas assemble, all the Buddhas from all parts of the galaxy, you could say, assemble and say hi to one another. I don't know what all the Buddhas do when they get together. But basically, Manjushri went to the assembly of the Buddhas and he found everybody was gone. They had all returned, you could say, to their home planets or the places where they originate from. Only a girl remained sitting in samadhi close to the Buddha's throne. Okay, Manjushri asked the Buddha, why can the girl get close to your throne but I can't? Why is it that this girl, you know, can get close to your throne and I can't? And I'm a great meditator, great bodhisattva. And Shakyamuni Buddha said, bring her out of samadhi and ask her yourself why she can get so close to my enlightenment and you can't. So Manjushri goes around her three times and snaps his fingers, but she won't come out of samadhi. And then the Buddha says, okay, well, you know, actually, even if there were 100,000 Manjushris, you couldn't wake her up. But there is one bodhisattva who could wake her up. And he's actually not a great bodhisattva at all. He's just a beginner, and his name is Momyo. And Momyo springs out of the ground, right? Which is, you know, Momyo comes out of the ground all of a sudden. And you can imagine him as you wish. Maybe he's kind of a comical-looking person. But he goes over and snaps his fingers and the girl comes out of samadhi right away. So, you know, if you think of this story as a sort of a fairy tale that you're supposed to internalize the way you would internalize a fictional story or a myth, the key idea here is coming out of samadhi, coming out of samadhi. So you could say the key phrase here, the turning phrase that you would internalize like a mantra would be comes out, comes out, comes out. Okay. So, I'm so glad you came to sit this morning. I look forward to these Saturday sits where we can get together and practice more deeply. You know, it's important to do daily practice. It's important to sit. Maybe you can sit for half an hour in the morning or 45 minutes or an hour even. Some of you sit twice a day, and that's wonderful. Very important. But it's really wonderful if people can do more sustained sitting. So it's not always possible to get up early on a Saturday and come here, but when you do that, you probably have a deep sit, you know. And some people come very early in the morning, and that gives them all a five-hour period of deep meditation. When you came here this morning, you might have been thinking about this sit in a very positive way. Maybe you yourself have been looking forward to coming here on a Saturday and sitting with other people. Maybe you have a lot of stresses in your life. It's been a busy 2 weeks. And you're thinking, I can't wait, really, to get up and come to sit in that room with other people. It's going to be quiet and peaceful, finally, right? You know, I've had such a hectic week. I got up early. I drove all the way over to Rutgers. I parked and I walked into the building, and I was looking forward to a nice, peaceful sit in a very quiet setting, you know. And you could imagine it. You know, it would be, you know, sometimes my office, some of you have come to my office, and you might have come at a time when it's really very busy, you know. Sometimes my office is like a madhouse, you know. It's just like a madhouse. We have a summer program for students from the inner city in New Brunswick. And it's a very successful program. I'm really proud of it. It's a summer enrichment program for kids who go to like a really poor high school, public high school. And we're getting a lot of these kids into college now after 4 years of summer enrichment. But it's very stressful running the program. And about a week and a half ago, I came back to my office at the end of the day, and my assistant was sitting in the office, and she was just sobbing. And I said, "What's wrong?" You know, and she said, "Oh, I'm just so, you know, burnt out. This has been so stressful, you know." And I understand, you know, I've been there myself. You know, that's sometimes, you know, we can have very challenging lives. You know, she has so many details to attend to, and things go wrong, and we're all, you know, trying to keep the ball rolling. And at the end of the day, you can just feel like crying. It can be very stressful. So she's a very wonderful person, and I love working with her. So anyway, you might have had a week like that. Maybe you didn't cry, but maybe you had a lot of stress. And you thought, I'm going to come here and sit, finally, and have some peace and quiet. And so you get out of your car, and you walk over, and there's a guy with a jackhammer drilling through the cement. And somebody else has those saws that cut through cement. So if you wanted to say what is the environment that is least conducive to meditation, it would be one where there's a guy standing outside with a jackhammer and somebody else is sawing through cement. That would be a cut above sawing through wood, right? It would be very, very loud. And so, you know, you might have looked at this and thought, oh my God, you know, this is going to be terrible. Terrible. And then, you know, when you came in, maybe it was better than you imagined, but maybe it was worse than you imagined. You know, and as you sit on the cushion, you know, as you come into the Zendo, listening to that noise, you might unconsciously find yourself becoming tense, or tightening up, right? It's like one expects something, you know, you're expecting a peaceful sit, and you come here, and there's this jackhammer going, and this guy with a saw, and you know, sort of swallow hard, and you come in the building, and then you sit down, and, you know, maybe the whole time you can't, you know, you settle down into, like, calm state, and then the saw comes on, you know, or then the jackhammer. And you're listening to that jackhammer, and you're thinking, oh, cripes, you know, if only this were over. And then it finally stops. And you think, oh, and then it's peaceful. And then it starts, you know. It's like, ah, you know. So, you know, you're like going up and down, up. And when it stops, it's like, finally I can rest. And then it starts up, and now your rest is broken up again, you know. So all of this is quite understandable. You know, all of this is quite understandable. And I understand that if we advertised in the paper, please come and meditate next to a jackhammer, no one would show up, right? Nevertheless, events like this are really good for your practice. And there is a way of misunderstanding Zen, which is really quite important to recognize, you know. You know, people think that meditation is about peace and stillness and calm. This is a common view. So, you know, basically, you know, it is true. When people meditate, if you meditate on a regular basis, after about 15 minutes, 10 or 15 minutes, you will regularly have a deep relaxation response. And if you practice regularly, it'll happen every time. So if you meditate regularly, you'll sit down on the cushion, and about 10 or 15 minutes into your sit, you'll have this deep relaxation response where you suddenly feel really wonderful. It's like, oh, thank God. And so many people conclude that this is really what Zen or meditation practice is all about, calming down, becoming relaxed, and so on and so on. You know, if you focus on your breath and you practice regularly, you will eventually have an experience of like bliss. You know, if you're sitting in an area, a place that's quiet and so on, and you practice regularly, within about a month or two, if you do this every day, you're going to sit down on the cushion and you're going to have this experience which is like blissful, right? Your mind is clear, you're focusing on your breath, you're calm, you know, you're stable, and you're feeling very relaxed, and all of a sudden you begin to have this powerful sense of well-being or connectedness. In Buddhism, our word for this is samadhi. Samadhi. Samadhi is very sweet. It's very delicious and delightful. And it's like candy. You know, it's like candy. It's very delicious. I myself love samadhi. You know, you know, I can enter samadhi very easily because I've been meditating for 35 years. At first, it's hit or miss. You might meditate and not hit samadhi. Sometimes you hit it, and then you can't find it again, you know. But eventually, you know, pretty much every time you sit down, you can get, samadhi is very, very accessible. You know, you sit down, you watch your breath, and have a deep relaxation response. You have this sort of blissful, it can be light or it can be deep, sense of connectedness, security, safety, well-being. And many people think this is the function of meditation. You know, in fact, in some traditions, samadhi is thought to be the end of the path, not the beginning. So samadhi is very beautiful. But, you know, the Buddha, in his training, experienced samadhi when he studied with other meditation masters of his time. But he correctly understood that samadhi is not enlightenment. See, samadhi is not enlightenment. So, maybe you meditate at home, and you have a quiet place where you sit. You know, your kids are gone, or your family's out, or you get up early in the morning before people are awake, and you know, maybe you light a little candle and some incense, and you watch the breath, and you enter samadhi. And you're in this blissful state, and you're thinking, oh man, meditation is really beautiful, you know? But then all of a sudden, you know, maybe outside of your house you hear, and you know, if you watch your reaction, you're probably going to be thinking, God damn it! You know, he's interrupting my beautiful samadhi. See? So this is very important, you know. People can enter this blissful, beautiful state, and it feels so unified with everything. But if something interrupts that state, people can become very angry or upset. Maybe you don't get anger, maybe a sense of helplessness or, you know. The fact that that emotion of that feeling of helplessness arises, or that feeling of anger arises, shows that it's not enlightenment. It's an important milestone in your meditation practice, but that experience of stillness and peace and so on is not enlightenment, because it doesn't really dissolve the boundary between yourself, your ego, and the world. And it actually can strengthen the ego boundary, you see. So if you're sitting in deep samadhi and you're feeling bliss, and somebody knocks at the door and you get mad at them, this shows that your ego is really alive and well and very, very separate from the world. It's like samadhi can become a kind of like protective cocoon we weave around ourselves, you see. And this can be, this is a, reflects an attitude of separateness, not unity. So, samadhi is absolutely indispensable. And if you meditate, you will be able to enter very, very deep states of samadhi. You must be able to do that. Having a light samadhi after 2 months of practice is important. But in our Zen tradition, we then enter even deeper states of samadhi, which are associated with the experience of emptiness. This is the mu koan. So actually, you could think of samadhi as representing a non-dualistic awareness, not separate awareness. So in samadhi, we unify ourselves with the object of our concentration. And when we do mu practice, we're unifying ourselves with emptiness, with shunyata, shunyata. And so, actually, mu, the mu koan, is the samadhi of emptiness. And we enter that samadhi so deeply that everything can appear to disappear. The world can disappear. In one of the other koans, it says that it says of a Zen practitioner, a great Zen practitioner, it says if you hit him with a stick when he's in deep samadhi, he won't even turn to look at you. He won't even notice. So it's very important to be able to enter very deep samadhi. The great Zen master, the greatest Zen master of the last 300 years, was a Chinese man named Xu Yun, empty cloud. He was born around the time of the American Civil War, and he died during the Red Guard period in China. So he lived more than 100 years. And he could go into samadhi for days. He would just go into deep, deep samadhi. One time, when he was living in the mountains by himself, he was making rice, and he started a little fire, and he put the rice in the water and put it on the fire. Waiting for it to cook, he decided to do some extra zazen, some extra meditation. He went into deep samadhi, and when he came out, the rice was cold, and basically it was day, you know, so he had meditated all night. So these kinds of stories about people who can enter deep samadhi are part of Zen literature. Being able to enter deep samadhi is crucial, but samadhi is not enlightenment. So, when you're in deep samadhi and you're having this blissful experience, you can find it very annoying to have any kind of external interruptions, such as somebody outside the room with a jackhammer. But if we are withdrawing from the present moment, when we withdraw from the present moment, this is always a sign that we are moving away from awakening instead of closer to awakening. I hope that makes sense. But awakening is always about dissolving the boundary between ourselves and the world. Now, sometimes the world is not what we want. It's not what we want, right? I mean, you might have come here this morning hoping for peace and stillness, and there's a guy with a jacket. You know, nobody wrote me and said, we'll be there on Saturday morning with jackhammers. You know, nobody told me. This is Rutgers. Nobody tells anybody anything, right? So basically, somebody just shows up and decides to do this on Saturday morning. He's just doing his job. He might be the most wonderful person in the world. He doesn't know we're in here. He's not trying to hurt us. But, you know, it's not the world we want. It's not the world we want. So, you know, we sit down on the cushion and maybe you hear the jackhammer and, you know, there's a part of you that just feels on edge. It's like you're on edge. You're listening to this, and as you listen, you're feeling your harmony and peace be shattered. And maybe you find yourself getting angry or frustrated, you know. Now, from the Zen standpoint, this is the most productive situation for growth. Okay? As I said, if we advertise regular jackhammers at every sit, no one will come. And I won't be there myself, I have to say. But nevertheless, you know, when reality is not what we want, we are in the situation where we can wake up. You know, you might think that the best place to be a practitioner of Zen would be a monastery, because you don't have any hassles, right? You know, in a monastery, you get up in the morning, and there's breakfast, and at lunch, you know, and so, you know, there's food is always there. you have a place to sleep. You don't get a bill at the end of the day, you know. You just show up and sit. You know, just show up for a minute. And, you know, everybody's there to meditate. You know, so it seems like that would be the perfect situation. You know, you know basically just meditation. No distractions. No challenges. No jackhammers. You know, peaceful up in the mountains. Beautiful. Birds are singing. It's not that way. You know, in Japan, most monasteries are incredibly cold in the winter. So, you know, when you come to sit, it's not like it's a temperature control. We have a little temperature control here. If it's 20 degrees outside, it's 20 degrees inside. So you sit down on the cushion and you think, oh my God, this cold. You know, it's horrible. And people actually get superficial frostbite. You know, and you sit there and you think, I hate this. I hate this. You know, in the summer, you know, in the summer in Zen temples, there's no heat, no air conditioning. You know, so, you know, when it's 100 degrees outside, it's 100 degrees inside. You know, and I've certainly practiced in that kind of, in both very cold and very warm, you know, if you sit in you're sitting in your robes and you're just drenched in sweat, right? Just breathing. So, you know, it's possible to say, this is horrible, I hate this, I hate this, I hate this. But, you know, when reality is not the way we want it, this is the opportunity for growth. There's no growth possible when reality is the way we want it. That's not a growth-producing situation. So, you know, when you come out of samadhi, often everything is very beautiful, very wonderful. You know, you do zazen, you're in deep samadhi, the birds are singing, you know, you get up from your cushion, you look outside, the flowers are blooming. It all seems like an enchanted magic land because you've been freed from your distractions and your distress and your mind is in the present moment. And that's wonderful. Please enjoy those beautiful moments. But sometimes, you know, you're in deep samadhi and then the world around you is not beautiful and wonderful and it's not a sunny day and the flowers aren't blooming and so on and so on. And that moment is where real growth can happen. You know, and believe me, if there aren't moments like that, nothing can change in your life. I was reading this book written. He's a psychiatrist, and it's it's a memoir he wrote. And he was talking about one of his patients, and the patient said something like, "I want to change, but I don't want to change anything in my life," and which is perfect. So human. We're all like that, right? You know. So I mean, we're all like that. You know, we all would like to be enlightened. Would you like to be enlightened? Yes, absolutely. How about if your legs hurt? Well, I'm not so sure. You know. How about if you're tired? I don't know. You know, maybe not. You know. So, I mean, basically, you know, awakening requires encountering obstacles and working through them. Some of those obstacles are in ourself. You know, some of those obstacles are in ourself, and the koan is helping us to deal with those obstacles. And some of the obstacles are presented to us by life, right? And those are very difficult, right? You know, I mean, basically we all like to be 100 years old, maybe, you know? We all imagine that, you know, maybe, you know, there's more and more centenarians. You know, if we get exercise and eat right, you know, 80, 90, 100, not out of the question, right? I remember my father got cancer when he was... My father retired at 65. He got cancer at 67, and he died at 69. And he was so bitterly disappointed, right? Because he had thought, you know, I'm going to be 90 years old. I'll be 90 years old. He had all these plans, and basically he retired. 2 years later, cancer... Two horrible years of, you know, illness, and then he died. So basically, you know, didn't work out the way my father planned it. And his last years were a struggle with this reality, which was not what he wanted. You know, it was a struggle with a life situation that was quite, you know, literally, you know, his life was coming to an end. How to come to terms with that? You know, that's a real, but that coming to terms with the reality we don't want is our opportunity to wake up. Nobody likes that situation, but it's the only way to wake up. I hope I'm clear. So, you know, basically, some people come to sit, and, you know, if you sit 20 minutes or so, you can get into a light samadhi with not much practice. And so it's possible to have a practice where you sit half an hour a day, you experience samadhi, and that does help. Being calmer helps you. It helps you deal with your stress. But, you know, if you want to get to deeper levels of concentration, you know, you have to sit longer. And if you sit longer, your legs are going to hurt. You know, they're just going to hurt. And if you recoil from pain on the cushion, the chances are you're recoiling from many difficult things in your life. You know, if pain is a barrier for you, physical pain, you know, it represents a really serious barrier to your practice, probably you've been probably you've been living a life where you're avoiding painful situations. It's just probably true. And that actually is probably not a good strategy for life. You know, most things that we do that are really worth doing involve some frustration. They involve failure, rejection, many different kinds of emotional distress, and even physical pain. You know, so if we're trying to live like a pain-free life, we're not going to have much of a life. And I myself dislike pain intensely, by the way. And I don't like to be frustrated. And I very much dislike failure, you know. But if you, I don't know anybody who says I like failure, you know. So look, but you can't grow without these things. Because when we encounter the limits of ourself, you know, that's where we can break through those limits. And when those limits fall away, we become one with this larger life. This larger life. See? And you know, so there's a process in real practice, real Zen practice. You know, you come up to a barrier. You're in a situation you don't like. You know, I came here on Saturday so I could have peace and quiet. And now there's a guy outside with a goddamn jackhammer, right? And you sit there and you think, I hate it, I hate it, I hate it, I hate it, right? But if you stay on the cushion and you don't get up and leave, if you keep coming back, you're in samadhi and you come back to that moment, it might not have happened today, but there will be a transformation. There will be a transformation. The most basic teaching of Zen is that every obstacle is a door. See, our collection of koans is called the Mu Meng Kan, the U Men Kwan, which you could translate as the no barrier checkpoint. That's probably the best translation of the Chinese, no barrier checkpoint. But the real implication, it's often translated in English as the gateless gate. And I really like that because the idea is that all of our barriers can turn into doors if we have the gumption to go through them. See? So everything we hate is potentially an opportunity to wake up. That's basically the lesson. And so Zen is all about confronting obstacles in ourselves that feel impassable, you see. And then we sit in deep samadhi with those obstacles, and suddenly there's an opening. It can take a while, you know. If you've ever gone to a sesshin and you've worked on a koan, you know, I worked on many koans with my teachers, and I would think, you know, I'd be sitting there in darkness and, you know, basically like despair, you know, and I'd go into the teacher, and I'd give him the answer, and they'd say no, you know, and then I'd sit down on the cushion and be in darkness and despair, go back and no, you know, go next day, no. And this is really hard for me, you know. When I was in high school, I used to get straight A's. I was a little nerd, you know, and that I couldn't excel in sports. I was not strong or big, and I wasn't, you know. Girls didn't seem to want to be my friend, you know. So I became a student. I became a really good student, and I if I didn't get an A, I was unhappy. So, you know, when I started doing Zen, I wasn't getting A's. I was getting like F's from my teacher. So I'd go into the Dokusan room and I'd say, "Here's what I think is the answer." No, 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 no. It was like F, 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 F. My Zen report card was covered with F's. So this was very hard for me. I really hated this aspect of Zen. But, you know, it was really good for me to encounter failure. It made me able to deal with failure in many other aspects of my life. And nobody can get through life without having rejection and failure and having to go back to the drawing board, you know. So, you know, when we encounter these obstacles in ourselves, you know, and we work through them, you know, the world becomes a bigger place. The boundary between ourself and the world becomes more open and porous. And we have, you know, you often have real joy, real joy. You know, most people who are advanced meditators really wouldn't be bothered by a jackhammer. That's the truth. You know, it's really the truth. You know, not tense, not, you know, if you're struggling with something like that, when you get off the cushion, you might feel a little tense. But, you know, if you've been doing this for a while, you know, it's just, it's no different from, you know, about a week ago, I went away for 7 days and was, you know, on the coast, listening to waves, you know, on a beautiful coastline in Maine. And, you know, I sat on the coastline and did my zazen and listened to the sound of waves, you know. And why is the sound of waves better than the sound of a jackhammer, right? It's, you know, actually not so different. But, you know, our culture so on says, oh, waves, they're beautiful, right? Maybe there's a culture somewhere where people say, oh, I hate the sound of waves, you know. I doubt it, but maybe there is such a place. So, you know, we have expectations, the jackhammer good, waves bad, but, you know, these are just, you know, these are just arbitrary judgments that have nothing to do with the nature of reality. What is reality? Reality is what is happening right now. So if you can harmonize yourself with the unfolding of the universe in the moment, something good can happen. And if you can't harmonize yourself with the unfolding of the universe in this moment, you are stuck, right? Just this is like Zen 101. So when we're stuck, we have to turn the barrier into an opening. Every barrier is a gate. Every barrier is a door into reality. Into reality. That's the basic message of Zen. So, you know, when you are, you know, when you're sitting on the cushion and your legs start to hurt, please move your legs, you know. If you don't move your legs and you focus on your breath, you'll notice that your concentration becomes deeper. Believe it or not, you know, after the first sit in this, after like around 10 or something, the jackhammers pretty much stopped. Everybody was sitting very deeply. You know, it's like, you know, listening, sitting and doing zazen and listening to jackhammers is like a little bit like swimming up a stream. You know, you become a really strong swimmer. You can develop a concentration, deep, deep concentration, you know, in a situation like that. You know, it's absolutely true that if you practice regularly and you practice with great sincerity, you can reach a point where your mind is absolutely imperturbable. It's like imperturbable mind. Would you like an imperturbable mind? Yes. How do you get there? By working through your barriers. So, you know, the situation of listening to jackhammers when you sit might not seem like the ideal thing, but actually very, very positive experience. You know, because you're sitting there and your concentration is difficult to sustain, and you have to focus more fully, and you don't like it, right? And but you know, at some point, when you get off the cushion, believe it or not, you're going to notice your mind is very deep. You know, your concentration is very deep. You know, what do I mean when I say your mind is very deep? When you look at your mind, it's like staring into a dark well. You know, during the ordinary day, when we look at our minds, it's like watching a movie, and there's something going on, or sitting in on a conversation, we're having an internal dialogue. So there's a movie playing in there, there's a conversation going on, you know, that we're having all these emotional responses. That's sort of like ordinary everyday consciousness. But after a morning of zazen, when you look at your mind, it can be like looking into the black water of a dark well. You're just looking down into that dark well, and it's absolutely dark. What does that mean? That blankness is the door into your bigger mind. That blankness is the door into your bigger mind, your awakened mind. And in Zen, we learn how to come up to that blankness and wait for it to guide us in our practice. That's really the essence of Zen. Once, in the old days, in the time of the world-honored one, Manjushri went to the assembly of the Buddhas and found that everyone had departed to his original dwelling place. Only a girl remained, sitting in samadhi close to the Buddha's throne. Manjushri asked Shakyamuni Buddha, "Why can the girl get near the Buddha's throne while I cannot?" Shakyamuni Buddha said, "Bring her out of samadhi and ask her yourself." Manjushri walked around the girl three times, snapping his fingers once, took her up to Brahma heaven, and exerted all his miraculous powers to bring her out of meditation, but in vain. The world-honored one said, "Even 100,000 Manjushris cannot make her wake up. But down below, past 1,200 million lands as innumerable as the sands of the Ganges, there is a bodhisattva named Momyo. He will emerge to arouse her from her samadhi." Instantly, the bodhisattva Momyo emerged from the earth and made a bow to the world-honored one, who gave him his order. The bodhisattva went over to the girl and snapped his fingers once. At this, she came out of samadhi. See, Momyo comes out of the ground. He comes out of the thing people think of spiritual practice as going up, away from the ground, right? But actually, liberation comes from everything around us, right? From this world we so much want to escape from. Momo's comment, old Shakyamuni put a petty drama on the stage and failed to enlighten the masses. Remember, when Momo says something is bad, he means it's good. So he's really saying Shakyamuni did a good job. "I want to ask you, Manjushri is the teacher of the seven Buddhas. Why couldn't he arouse the girl from her samadhi? How was it that Momyo, a bodhisattva at the beginner stage, could do it? If you understand this intimately, you will enjoy Nagya's grand samadhi in the busiest activity of consciousness." In other words, you know, if you keep doing this, if you break through your barriers, you can be in deep samadhi in the middle of, you know, Times Square. That's the point. You know, if you keep practicing, you will be in this imperturbable mind, even in the middle of Fifth Avenue in New York, with the horns honking, hot summer sun overhead, and so on. Calm and clear as a lake without wind. Mumon's verse, "One was successful, the other was not. Both secured freedom of mind." one in a God mask, the other in a devil's mask, even in defeat, a beautiful performance.